Listen into Friends with Benefits, and we have Bluceris Consulting Managing Partner Michelle Hager on the phone with us. Hi, Michelle. I thought Senator O'Connor and Kyle Zebley did a great job covering a lot of ground on how our state of Massachusetts is doing with using telehealth to fight the COVID-19 pandemic.
Hi, Joe. So glad to be here. I'm really excited to attend that world's largest telehealth innovation event at ATA in person in 2022 on May 1st through the 3rd in your hometown, Boston.
Whoop, whoop. Let's go, Boston. Let's do it. So I am super excited about this in-person conference right here in my hometown of Boston. I remember attending my first ATA conference in Chicago with you. I think it was in 2015 with Dr. Peter Yellowlees, who is a professor of psychiatry and chief wellness officer at UC Davis. He was very supportive of telemental health back then. And I can only imagine he's leading the charge today for our youth. So on to our show. Our next guest on the radio show is a awesome husband and wife team from Maryland. We've spoken to them before on the show, Dr. Yael Harris and Jason Goldwater.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yep. Thanks for having us on the show.
This is the second time you guys have been on. It's great to have you.
Yeah. So Dr. Harris and Jason, you are the owners of Laurel Health Advisors, a small disadvantaged women-owned business. You worked on compiling data for CMS on the use of telehealth services during this national public health emergency. Medicare will pay for telehealth services without many of these restrictions. In 2020, CMS released guidance for new Medicare telehealth flexibility, stating in response to COVID-19 public health emergency, telehealth services are temporarily available to many more Medicare patients than before the pandemic. Before the new law, telehealth services in Medicare were only available under limited circumstances, mostly for patients located in rural areas who traveled to local medical facilities, practitioners at a separate physical location, effective March 6, 2020. And for the duration of this national public health emergency, Medicare will pay for telehealth services without many of these restrictions. What do you think of that, Michelle?
Joe. That was a mouthful. It's important that people know that their physicians can be paid for the services of telehealth. And I know that Jason and Yael will spend a good bit of time today talking to us about some of the things that they've learned in their research and some of the things that we've learned over the course of the year. It's important to understand where you need to advocate. And we talked about that with Senator O'Connor, who's being well represented. The district is well represented by him, and people need to talk to him and his colleagues to make sure that these services are available and these physicians are being paid. But Jason and Yael, share what you found in your research over the last year or so.
Sure. Thanks so much, Michelle. So I'll start with overview of the inception of the study. Basically, what are our demographic findings, which kind of tell you who was using telehealth during the pandemic and what types of services. And then Jason ran a robust cost-benefit model and can tell you how the use of telehealth impacted savings for both Medicare and Medicaid. So this was actually part of a three-phase process. The first stage, Congress had indicated when they scored legislation several years ago, entities had come to them and said, you know, we're not sure if your scoring was correct. And Congress said, well, we really need more data then, and it needs to be nonpartisan, non-biased. We need more data to help inform our decision-making. So the Center for Telehealth and eHealth Law did a comprehensive review of articles, about 16,000 articles. And what they found is that, I'm not surprising to you guys, the data is all over the place in terms of different health systems, different types of patients, different telehealth service types, different ways of measuring telehealth cost savings. So while there are a lot of positive findings, they couldn't be aggregated to draw a conclusion that would be useful to Congress. So the next stage in the process was to develop what we called a data dictionary, which Jason spearheaded, which would standardize data from different health systems so that we could aggregate data and tell a story that comprised a large set of data. The timing ended up actually being perfect or not perfect, as you may call it, in that by the time the data dictionary was finalized and we started data collection, we were at the start of the pandemic. And so we had six health systems across America share their data with us from the periods of March through September of 2020. We also got all of the Medicaid encounter data on every telehealth encounter in the state of Arizona during that time period, which was wonderful information and very comprehensive. So in the end, we had 1.43 million telehealth encounters during that period. These were just for regular health services, not COVID-related services. So any types of services that would have been provided in the absence of the pandemic. The data also represented every single state in the United States, as well as we had some overseas data and some data from the territories, and every single payer type. So everything from Medicare fee-for-service, Medicare Advantage, to private pay, veterans, and also charity care and private payers. The data we collected was a range, including information at the patient level, such as race and ethnicity, age within an age band, and the first three digits of their zip code. All of this falls into the HIPAA safe harbor and provide enough information to really narrow down the racial distribution of who used services, the age ranges, as well as where these services were provided by county and how far they were from the provider delivering the care. We also got their diagnoses, past medical history, the services that were provided, as well as information on their lab orders and medications. So what we found was that telehealth was widely used, of course, across America. What we found was the increased use spiked in April, actually, went up in March and then spiked in April with slight decline, significantly declining in September, however, still at a rate of about 300% higher than it had been at any time prior to the pandemic. So in spite of people saying telehealth's use is declining, it actually is still significantly higher than it ever has been. And our work in terms of talking to patients, providers, as well as looking at studies, have found that providers intend to continue using this, patients continue to ask for telehealth services. So we don't see telehealth going away. We see it as moving towards a hybrid model, which Jason will describe in more detail. We also found that our analysis showed that the distribution of telehealth utilization surprisingly represented the geographic, the demographics of the United States. While we had slightly more Medicaid patients, for the reason that we had all of the data from Arizona's Medicaid, we did have a similar percentage of people who are on Medicare also using telehealth, and a slightly higher use of privately insured people using telehealth with a slightly lower use of self-pay, definitely not surprising. We also found a very similar mix to the racial and ethnic composition of the United States. Slightly more Latino Americans use telehealth than the population demographics. We had roughly the same use of telehealth by Black Americans, slightly higher use by white Americans, and an underrepresentation by Asian Americans. Now, I want to caveat that by saying the data did not include a lot of data from California and the West Coast. So that may either be an underrepresentation of the population, or it may just be the sample that we used at the time did not reflect that type of population. Mm-hmm. We also looked at the age distribution. And as you know, use of healthcare grows by age. We saw that same thing. However, surprisingly, we saw a very high use of telehealth that exceeded the national demographics for youth under the age of 18. So young adults, children, and adolescents. What we did see is that Medicaid paid for roughly 50% of services in both urban and rural areas. And the telehealth use across those areas was reflected where people live. So we have about 20% of the population living in rural areas in the United States, according to the US Census. And distribution was about 22% use of telehealth from rural areas, and the rest were used by people residing in urban areas. I also wanted to quickly give a background on what types of services were provided by telehealth. So overwhelmingly, the types of services that were used were for established patient care. So what that means is these are patients that already had an established visit with that provider and were not new patients. In fact, the data suggests that less than 15%, probably less than 10% of these encounters were new patients. In other words, patients that had not established a visit with that provider. Other common service uses were case management, care coordination, and about 10% of the services were what we call telephone E&M, which means that they were telephone-based services. And Jason will discuss more about that in a minute. Finally, the types of conditions that we saw, overwhelmingly, patients had a diagnosis of behavioral and mental health. Very stark in every single state and territory. The average was about a third of all patients. However, in certain states, it was closer to 50 or even higher, especially under certain populations. We also found common conditions were endocrine, such as diabetes, pulmonological, including COPD and heart disease, and quite a few people were using telehealth for cancer care. So I'm going to turn over to Jason now to describe the cost-benefit findings, and then we'll discuss what all of this means in terms of informing policy.
Thank you, Yael.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Yael. So when we decided to develop a cost-benefit model, cost-benefit is not overly complicated analysis. It's fairly straightforward, but the challenge is identifying what variables you want to use for cost and what variables you want to use for benefits. And so we established three guiding principles to help us as we develop the analysis. The first was to not reinvent the wheel. So like I said, cost benefit is fairly straightforward, and there have been studies done in the past on cost benefit. They've been local or statewide studies. They have not been national, but the methods that they used to conduct that analysis can be used nationally. So where it was possible, we used these models and just extrapolated them out so we could use national data rather than local data. The second was to be as conservative as possible in our estimates. So as with any study design, you have to always make assumptions. So where we had to do that, we were as conservative as we could be, and did that specifically so we would not invite criticism that the study was biased. So Yael and I have been working in telehealth for a long time, and we didn't want anybody to get the impression that we were advocating strongly for telehealth by showing significant cost benefit. We wanted it to be fairly straightforward that people could come to that same conclusion. And the third principle was to ensure that we're telling the right story. So not just presenting a lot of data, but making sure that there's a story behind the data that people can understand and relate to, so they can truly understand what it means when we say telehealth is cost beneficial. What does that translate to in terms of care for individuals? So with that in mind, we developed the cost-benefit model, and the variables we used for cost were personnel costs, so the salaries of providers, nurses, nurse practitioners, and fringe benefits, which we capped at 30%, which is a fairly standard number. We looked at broadband per month for both patient and provider, and we found out what the average cost of broadband would be in the states that we were focused on. And we made sure that the broadband service we were looking at was able to, at a minimum, provide a video visit. We figured that there are lots of modalities that can be used for telehealth, but at a minimum, if people are going to subscribe to broadband, it should be able to facilitate a video visit with a doctor. And the third was maintenance. So none of the programs that we got data from acquired a new system. They were all using an existing system, but we still had to figure out what the maintenance costs were during the time period we were studying. So we found out what the cost of those systems were and what the depreciated value was, and that's what we used for maintenance. It should also be noted that we only looked at a 7-month time period. We only looked from March through September. So we looked at broadband costs for that, salaries within the 7-month period, and what the maintenance costs would be in that 7-month period. In terms of savings, what we looked at was reduction in hospitalizations, figuring if they had an encounter with a provider through telehealth, that would remove the possibility they would have to go into the hospital. And we set that at 10%. Now we looked to the literature again, and there were ranges everywhere from 5 to 20%. We felt 10%, which was the average of those, was probably very reasonable and very conservative. We don't doubt that we were underestimating that. But again, going to our second guiding principle to be as conservative as possible, that's what we chose. We also looked at patient travel, so how long it took for an individual to get from their residence to an in-person facility if they had to go to one, and how long it would take to go back. So we used Google Maps for this. So we picked 10 random addresses in the counties we were focused on and calculated how long it would be for them to go to a provider in the same county. So we looked for those that would accept Medicare and those that would accept Medicaid and those that would accept those insurances for the particular condition we were focused on. We also looked at patient productivity. So that's what wages are being lost by taking time off to go see an in-person provider. We only focused on Medicaid for that. We made the assumption, again, that those on Medicare were probably retired. That's more than likely not always the case. But just because of the study itself, we'd rather be safe than sorry. So we just focused on the Medicaid population. And what we did is we found out what the threshold to qualify for Medicaid would be for a family of four. And we divided that salary number by the number of business hours in a year. And we came up with what we call the Medicaid minimum wage. And then we multiplied that by the time it would take for somebody to get to and from a provider. And that's how much they would lose. We also looked at environmental impact. So we looked at the amount of nitrous oxide and carbon dioxide emissions that were being burned, either through personal transportation or through public transportation. And then we used calculators on the Environmental Protection Agency's website to translate those emissions into how much gallons of gas they were burning and what that would cost. So we didn't want to just look at environmental emissions as just sort of abstractly thinking this is how many emissions you burn. We wanted it to make it much more relatable by showing this is how it's actually much it's actually costing. And we found, as we've discussed this study in over the last 3 or 4 months, that the federal government, particularly the White House, is really, really interested in this. This is something that they find that has a lot of far-reaching impact about why telehealth should be continued. So we're happy that we were able to provide that analysis. And while I'd love to sit here and say, Yael and I thought of this all by ourselves, we did not. We found it in a study that had been conducted by a researcher out in Arizona, and we decided to use the same model, but went a little bit further to translate that into gas costs. So when we conducted all of this analysis, we found substantial cost savings for both the Medicare and Medicaid programs, ranging anywhere from $450,000 to, in the case of Arizona, over $191 million. And that was just for a 7-month period. So the only state we did not find cost savings in was the state of New York. And there's a couple of reasons for that. So with Medicaid, our sample size was really small. It was only 300 people. And everybody that was on Medicaid that used telehealth either came from the 5 boroughs of New York City or they came from Long Island. So those are highly dense areas with lots and lots of people. And so telehealth was not really a necessity more than as much as it was a convenience. So they could use telehealth if they wanted to, but there weren't providers that were 70 or 80 miles away that they'd have to travel to. There was providers everywhere, and particularly in Medicare, where we had a much larger sample size, and the condition that we focused on there was cardiology or cardiovascular disease. And again, everybody that was on Medicare that used telehealth came from the 5 boroughs or Long Island, and there are hundreds upon hundreds of cardiologists in those areas. So I think the furthest we found any cardiologist away from any patient was less than 5 miles. So again, they were using telehealth because it was convenient, not because it was a necessity, because a cardiologist was 80 to 100 miles away one way. So because of that, we didn't show any net savings, but that does not have anything to do with the program, Northwell Health, which generously gave us that data. Northwell has an astonishingly good telehealth program that they've been running for a very, very long time. It's just where the data happened to come from. It didn't show cost savings. I think if we had had a larger sample size and we had had data from all points of New York, not just New York City and Long Island, we certainly would have seen the same cost savings we saw in every other state. What the cost savings means is that not only does it produce the significant savings as opposed to in-person health, we found that just the volume of encounters that we looked at, which was just over 1.43, show that telehealth can be substitutive instead of additive. Mm-hmm. So people were using these services to substitute for in-person care and were thinking that it was providing the same type of care that they were getting in person. And we also found out that the more you're using telehealth, which we saw, the more savings are being accrued. So in addition to the savings to the individuals, there was also savings to both programs, because the more that they were using it, they're staying out of the hospital, their condition's not exacerbating to the point that now it's gotten much worse, more costs are going to have to be sunk in to take care of the patient. They're getting the care they need when that care is essential. And that's really kind of one of the stories behind this, that not only does it save a lot of money, it was providing essential care at times when people truly needed it, especially during the pandemic when that was really the only option of care.
I've always found this study to be fascinating. I hope that our listeners understand just the impact there of the study itself, even though it was a large amount of people and participating. That is just the tip of the iceberg. We really need a lot more data for that to be a more effective identification tool for, as you mentioned, this, you know, the Congressional Budget Office, when they score this and how they decide how healthcare costs are defined. So if there's any healthcare folks that are listening that have access to hospital data, give us a contact because we would love to be able to, you know, receive your anonymized information to be able to continue to participate in this study. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, because I know you're passionate about some of the data that you found that I think was surprising, particularly around children and adolescents that had mental health services. Talk a little bit about that and the access to care challenges that you saw in just this smaller sample set.
So sure. So mental and behavioral health. So what we did, let me go back a ways, is that we looked at the top conditions, top five conditions of every state that we received data from, both from the Medicaid populations and Medicare. Those were the only two that we were focused on. And not surprisingly, mental and behavioral health was the number one condition for a majority of these cases, both populations, particularly Medicaid. And in Arizona specifically, where we got just over 472,000 patients, 91% of that population had a mental and behavioral health disorder. And out of that 91%, almost 60% of them were children or adolescents. And what became, I want to say it's both interesting and it's a little unsettling, is that the types of conditions these individuals had, these children, they were not just, I think what people would say is depression and anxiety, which is significant, don't undermine those conditions, but they had, you know, they're suffering from opioid abuse, alcoholism, substance use, PTSD, adjustment disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, very, very significant conditions that absolutely require medical attention. And when you look at a case like Arizona, for example, we looked at the counties that were most frequently using telehealth services. And what we found is the most frequent ones were incredibly rural counties, like in the southwesternmost part of the state, bordering Mexico, or on areas that had lots of Native American reservations with limited access to care. And without telehealth, they're not getting care. It's really just sort of that simple, that they're struggling with these conditions, probably with a number of other ones that we did not see or in the data set that we had. And there's no access to care unless they get into a car, which they probably don't have,
right?
And go 90 miles one way to a federally qualified health center to get care and then turn around and come back. And who knows when they will get to that provider again. And who knows what types of care are going to be needed? And who knows if an individual in that FQHC is qualified to be dealing with these particular conditions that these children have? Right. And so, like we said, our third guiding principle was to tell a story. And I think that's the most powerful one, that you have children and adolescents that are suffering from serious mental health conditions that absolutely need care. And the only way that care is going to be delivered is virtually. And so telehealth provided an absolutely essential service to a crisis that is only getting worse. And in addition to saving money, it's providing essential and needed care to children that absolutely have to be able to leverage that care to take care of themselves. Yeah.
Wow. I could just add to Jason's comments. This is not just about individuals' health needs. This is a population and a public health issue. These are populations that, need access to critical services, or they will impact public health in general and the population. Think about gun control laws. Think about issues associated with someone having a break from reality. Access to healthcare services for these populations is essential to not only help them and their families, but to help the population lives around them.
Yeah, a real societal problem here. And those of us that are in healthcare every day, we know the cost of this. Those are real costs that we're all paying. So we need to help them get that care so that we're not just going to the, trying to go to the emergency room or not accessing care at all, as you point out, Jason. And that story of what's happening with some of these children, it's not Arizona alone. This is in every state in the country. So even in the megalopolises of, you know, Boston and New York and et cetera, they're still having these challenges with people not being able to access these services. And innovations like telehealth are important. So message, talk to your legislator, tell them to call Senator O'Connor, who's a supporter of this, and his colleagues in your districts. And Joe, I know you're a great ambassador for the state of Massachusetts, but any of our listeners, either live or as it's recorded, please contact your local representatives.
Yeah, the number is 617-722-1646, room 419, extension 419 for Senator Patrick O'Connor, who's doing a great job. And we heard Governor Baker give his speech last night to the state of Massachusetts, and he was all over telehealth and how necessary telehealth is to the healthcare of our communities and to our children. That is some great information and data you shared with us, Jason and Dr. Yael Harris. Thank you so much for your time tonight. We've always said telehealth saves lives, saves time, and saves money, but now it's green. It saves the environment. So we'll have to add that to our slogan.
It does.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us. And it was enlightening. Thank you
for the opportunity to share.
Yep. Thank you guys. Thanks both.
Thanks everyone. This is Friends with Benefits on WATD Radio 95.9 FM. Thank you for listening.